Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Olivia Lang, adventures in the art of being alone, in her book The Lonely City, and then geographer Joshua Jelly Shapiro on the Caribbean and the world, in his debut book Island People. Olivia Lang is a widely acclaimed writer and critic. Her work appears in numerous publications, including The Guardian, Observer, New Statesman, Freeze, and New York Times. Her first book, To the River, was shortlisted for the Royal Society of Literature Ondaatje Prize and was the Dolman Travel Book of the Year. The Trip to Echo Spring, which we talked about in a previous Little Atoms, was shortlisted for the 2013 Costa Biography Award and the 2014 Gordon Byrne Prize. And her latest book, The Lonely City, was also shortlisted for the 2016 Gordon Byrne Prize. And that's the book we're going to talk about today. Olivia, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Hi, nice to be back.
I'd normally say, what's this book about? But let's approach it by saying, how did this book come about?
Okay, well, it came about by me being thoroughly miserable in New York. It came about quite naturally. I hadn't intended to write a book about loneliness. I was working on Echo Spring and I was living in New York and a relationship had just ended. Relationship had ended that I was going to move to New York for, and I decided that I'd come anyway on my own. And I was incredibly lonely. I was moving from sublet to sublet, and it was quite a sort of disconnected experience and deeply uncomfortable, but at the same time there was something very intriguing about it. People don't talk about loneliness, people don't write about loneliness. It's this sort of taboo, shameful state that you're not supposed to cop to, admit to. And that, for me as a writer, you know, I'm drawn by those sort of taboo states. So I was really fascinated by it. I wanted to get to grips with it. So I started to sort of record the experience, and that gradually built into the book.
To the extent it's, you know, it's not talked about, it's shameful, to the extent that people don't really study loneliness either as a thing, do they? You do talk about some psychologists that have started to study loneliness as a condition itself, but it is a relatively recent thing.
Yeah, absolutely, which was really surprising to me. I think there's such a sort of human sense of wanting to steer clear from it, feeling like it might be infectious or invasive in some way, that it's going to take you over. I think that even affected psychologists who were studying it. So Freud never mentions loneliness. He talks about anxiety, he talks about depression, he talks about grief. But loneliness is this sort of separate thing that doesn't get mentioned. The very early psychologists who started looking at it in the 50s, Frieda von Reichmann is a particular example, talked very much about how weird it was, what a weird subject it was, that it was so sort of surrounded by silence. And now scientists are really grappling with it much more. When I was writing about it, it was just starting to be much more written about subject. In the last year or so, I think there are really quite a lot of pieces being written. But it has had this sort of almost uncanny effect on people.
And loneliness is a, what should we call it, a condition, an affliction, a thing that if you're lonely and you're suffering loneliness, you sort of make yourself more lonely. You become more and more withdrawn. Mm. It becomes more and more difficult to connect to people as well.
Yeah, it's this sort of terrifying vicious circle. And I hadn't really... This is the thing that I most got from the psychologists, is the way that that vicious circle works. So the more lonely you become, the less good you seem to get at picking up social signals. So you start to, without realising it, your sense of the encounters that you're having starts to warp towards very negative encounters. Mm-hmm. You feel that people have been rude to you. You remember the occasions in which somebody's been a bit cold or a bit off. And in response, you pull away more and more, so those start escalating. But you don't realise that's happened. Your brain has become hyper-alert to threat because loneliness is a dangerous state for us. And you start to accelerate your own loneliness unwittingly, which I found really terrifying to read about, to discover. And it also made sense of my own experience, which was that I was definitely becoming more paranoid, more wary, less open in my encounters with people.
Well, let's talk about your experience for a bit. So back to New York. So to begin with, before we get to, you know, what this book is about, how did you deal?
How did I deal? Well, I did have a lot of friends in New York, but I was still, you know, I'm a writer, so there wasn't a job that I was going to each day. I was working alone all day. I was living in sublets rather than with people. My family, my very close friends that I'd known for a long time, were in a different continent. So I was having an experience of spending a lot of time on my own. And at the same time, I was heartbroken. So I think that sort of was colouring my experience. And then there was just the physical experience of living in New York, that I'd be living in these buildings, in these sublets, and maybe have a room or a couple of rooms. And I'd be looking out of my window at all these other windows, hundreds and hundreds of other windows, other people's lives, which invariably felt more populated and more successful than mine. And that sort of magnified the experience. That's what made me think urban loneliness as its own current is really fascinating. I mean, there's rural loneliness, there's suburban loneliness, but there was something about the particular flavour of urban loneliness that I got very interested by.
Well, the idea of being lonely when you're surrounded by millions of other people rather than in the middle of nowhere, for sure. Let's talk about what the book is about then. So as I said, how did you deal with being lonely yourself? And this book, as well as being an exploration of your, you know, your own coping with loneliness, it's a series of profiles of artists that you we'll talk about as we go through them, aspects of loneliness in their own work as well.
Yeah.
But why did you gravitate to this? Why do you think in your particular condition, art was what you were looking for?
It's really hard to say. I think initially I was aware of loneliness as a visual phenomenon, that the thing about the windows, the glass, it seemed like it was a sort of visual representation of the state itself. And it was a state I wanted to map. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of physically map it, which is what led me to Hopper.
Yeah.
At the same time, when we're talking about loneliness as an urban experience, I was very interested in it as different from solitude, that it was a sort of populated experience. And I wanted to look at lots of different people who'd inhabited it in different ways. So I definitely wanted to explore it by way of somebody who was an absolute outsider, who was a shut-in, who was a hoarder. But I also wanted to think about people who were lonely but sociable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what drew me to Andy Warhol. And then I wanted to think about people who'd used art as a way of making contact with other people, as a way of resisting loneliness. And that's what drew me to David Wojnarowicz. So I was sort of looking for people that had very diverse experiences of loneliness. But then the other thing was that I needed to really love their art. That was what sort of drew me in the first place.
So Edward Hopper, who you've mentioned, I mean, people will sort of picture as the absolute archetypal artist of that condition of being in a city with lit windows on your own, surrounded. Talk us through when you first saw Nighthawks in the actual, you know, in the
canvas. That was amazing because I'd been studying it and writing about it at that point for a very long time, but I'd been looking at it mostly on my computer. And there was a show, I think it was at the Met or the Whitney, one or the other, and it was absolutely packed because he's such a popular artist. So I was sort of drifting from room to room, kind of looking at everything, but really feeling very excited about seeing Nighthawks. And there was a huge crowd in front of it, sort of parted, and it's the most fantastic colour, that painting. It's got this very eerie aquarium green, this sort of neon green that is absolutely beautiful and artificial and unnatural and very much about the human in the city. It didn't exist before the human in the city. Mm-hmm. So that colour, the impact of that was very intense. And then just seeing, I mean, this is a painting of people in a diner, four people in a diner, and they're separated from each other by all sorts of clever little constructions that you don't necessarily realise. You pick up the feeling of it without necessarily sort of breaking down the architecture. They're separated by glass, they're separated by a bar, there isn't a door to the room, they're in this sort of prison, really. And I found it very moving, actually, seeing that painting, seeing little drips that I'd never noticed before, because it's not the sort of thing that picks up on a laptop screen. And, it's a sublimely moving illustration of a state that I felt very familiar with.
You talk about Hopper's relationship with his wife, Jo. Yeah, which is a interesting, shall we say, relationship.
I'm screwing up my face.
I wonder, once you'd found that out, how that reflects back on his art.
Oh, God, it made a huge difference. I mean, I didn't know very much about Hopper at all, really. I was very familiar with his paintings, as probably most people are, because they're so endlessly reproduced. But I didn't know much about him, and he married very late. He was quite a sort of isolated man, and he married late another artist, also in her 40s. And from the Hopper biography and from her own letters and diaries, it becomes apparent that he really tried to suppress her as an artist, that he kept her quite isolated, and that their relationship certainly sometimes became violent. I found it very hard to stay on board with Hopper after that. I think he's a fantastic artist, and I think that's sort of separate from his personality, but it certainly coloured how I looked at his paintings, which are very much about silences, failed communication, mistrust, these sort of layers of division between people. So I think something of his biography flows into that, and it was illuminating, but at the same time, it was really disturbing to read as well.
Yeah, well, I was going to say next, well, how does, you know, the loneliness of his own life, which obviously we can see that in the paintings, but how is that reflected back into his own life, do you think?
How did the loneliness affect him in his own life?
Yeah.
It's interesting, his friend Brian Doherty speaks about Hopper's silence, that he was somebody who found it very hard to reach out verbally and who had a real quality of separation about him. He wasn't a sort of warm or unbending man. And that obviously fed his art quite intensely, but maybe didn't make him the easiest person to live with or be. And he's interesting when he talks about his work, because he's always very sort of resistant to being pinned down mm-hmm. about what his work means.
Yeah, he certainly doesn't think it's about...
Well, he does and he doesn't, because he will say, yes, it's about the loneliness of a big city. And when pressed in one interview, he says this really lovely thing. He says, I suppose I'm a lonely one. And I always really liked that, because it really seemed to hit on something that his paintings show, which is that loneliness is a common state. There are mm-hmm. all of these people in his paintings, individually, absolutely isolated. But they're a group of people, they're a body of people, they're the lonely ones. And that is the thing that I think is most generous about his art, is that he's showing loneliness to us as a shared state, as a democratic state.
I'm David Stubbs. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
The next section looks at Andy Warhol. And again, as I think you've already hinted at, not necessarily somebody that people would immediately presume yeah. would be in a study of loneliness, because he was surrounded by people constantly. I mean, that's what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. And even when he's not, when he can bear to break away from people to go to bed, he's got the TV on because he cannot be alone. But at the same time, he's absolutely a lonely person too. Mm-hmm. Somebody who found it very, very hard to make intimate contact with other people. I mean, he had a huge amount of friends, but he really struggled with intimacy and certainly with sexual intimate relationships. And what really excited me about Warhol was the way that he solved that problem for himself was to use technology in various ways. Mm-hmm. So starting with the Philips tape recorder that he gets in the 1960s, and then moving on into all kinds of cameras, movie cameras, Super 8s, the Polaroids that he has at parties in the 80s. He uses these devices to record the people around him, which is both a way of getting people close to you, sort of drawing them in, everyone wants to be filmed by Andy, but also holding them at a distance mm-hmm. because you're the one behind the camera. And actually, when he was filming, quite often he'd just walk away from the camera and leave the person with the camera. So this sort of way of guarding himself from closeness that I found really interesting, because I was in New York at the moment where everyone had just fallen in love with a smartphone. Everyone around me constantly was working away on their smartphone, taking photos of themselves. Mm-hmm. This sort of sense that Andy, as in so many things, was the sort of avatar of the present day, that he saw this coming.
And he's, I mean, apart from being, you know, an incredibly shy person, yeah. he really doesn't like himself. He doesn't have a particularly high opinion of him. He thinks he's, like, completely unlovable.
Yeah.
Which obviously then plays into, you know, the way that he is perceived by other people, but the way that he obviously approaches other people himself.
Yeah, and, I mean, the pursuit for beauty throughout his life, both trying to sort of beautify himself in various ways. He's always knocking around at home, fiddling with his wig glue
and the wig
putting on makeup. but being obsessed with beauties as well, and having very attractive people around him, and feeling absolutely horrendous about his own appearance. Sort of torment. I mean, when you read his diaries, which are incredibly funny, but are perpetually tormented by his skin and his nose and what he looks like, his body, and he's trying to work out and he's trying to get fitter and all these different things, that are this deep sense of sort of feeling shameful and feeling unlovable.
And what about the work? I mean, in his sort of project to reproduce image after image of the same thing, I mean, again, is this some sort of another one of his coping mechanisms?
I mean, I think it's not just a coping mechanism, because he's also a very, very knowing artist, and he's doing things that he thinks are intellectually exciting as well. But there's definitely something in his work, I think, about the pursuit of sameness, that when he's making the screen prints, which starts to happen in the 60s, he's very excited about the idea of these being common objects. He wanted to call pop art common art. And the sort of replication of things over and over again, the reassurance of every Coke bottle being the same, whether it's being drunk by a president or a miner, that's reassuring to him because he feels so excruciatingly isolated and so different. So he's excited by the idea that you could be identical. And I think that's a sort of pulse that runs through his art right to the end, really.
This chapter is also a study of Valerie Solanas, who now is most famous for having shot him.
Yeah.
But has an incredibly eventful and tragic life herself. Tell us something about her, because clearly you are keen to rehabilitate her, is perhaps the wrong word, but certainly.
No, I think in some ways rehabilitate her. I felt like she'd been really hard done by, and I was really interested. The Brianne Farr's biography of Valerie Solanas had just come out, which is a really amazing book, and I was really interested by how parallel her and Andy's lives were, that they were actually quite similar. They were both from sort of working class immigrant backgrounds. They're both gay. They both felt very isolated growing up, sort of semi-bullied growing up. And they're both hugely sort of talented, come to New York sort of crackling with talent. But Warhol finds his way. Warhol finds his people. I mean, it takes him a long time. There's a lot of doing magazine illustration work and really not feeling like things are taking off for him. But he does manage to create this unbelievably rich social life for himself. Valerie, on the other hand, cannot make those sort of connections. She can't really connect with other people by way of her work, and that's the thing she most wants to do. She wants people to publish her work, she wants people to read her work, she wants people to be excited by it. And her and Warhol fall out over a series of misunderstandings about him publishing something for her, him using her work in some way, and she becomes incredibly paranoid. You can see that cycle of loneliness at, really, I think, almost its most malevolent in Valerie Solanas, that she gets more and more isolated and paranoid until she shoots Warhol. Then she ends up in prison. And then you start seeing this other thing about loneliness, which is the isolation that happens to people who are stigmatised by the state rather than just by individuals. That she comes out of prison, I mean, really violent experiences in prison, and she comes out and people would spit at her in the street. People picked up this sort of weirdness or oddness about her and really punished her for it. So on the one hand she's sort of paranoid, and on the other hand she's picking up on what people are genuinely thinking about her, and it really creates this sort of breach between her and the day-to-day society. So she falls into mental illness and she ends up dying in a welfare hotel in boarding house in San Francisco, and isn't found for 4 days, and when the super comes in her body's covered in maggots. And that seemed to me like the end of the road for loneliness. That's the most extreme story, I think, in the book. I mean, there's Henry Darger as well, but she really was completely cut off. And yet her work is so exciting. Reading the Scum Manifesto was just, it's bonkers, it's wild. Some of it is absolutely indefensible, but some of it is really smart. And she's not writing like anybody else. And that, again, it felt really exciting to me, that there's this, you know, sort of counter story to the Warhol story, in the same way that Edward Hopper's wife is a sort of counter to Hopper's wife, who was in many ways just as talented.
She's also particularly interested in the way that, even, you know, on a more basic level than, you know, somebody who's stigmatised by a prison sentence or something, how society itself isolates women, you know, the patriarchy isolates women from each other.
Yeah, and she can absolutely see that. And I mean, this is the moment when The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan has only just been published. It's so early days in feminism, and she's writing stuff that I think even today third wave feminists would struggle to get their heads around, because it's you know, it's woke. It's really, like, it's super alert to how structures damage people, and people find that really challenging.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Olivia Lang. We're talking about her book, The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone. And Olivia, you mentioned in the first part Henry Darga as an aside, another one of the artists that you profile.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to let you tell us who he is, because this is a remarkable story.
Yeah, it's a really interesting and troubling story. So he was the Chicago janitor. He lived in a boarding house, and he'd had a very sort of distressing childhood. His mother had died when he was very young. His father had been disabled and not able to care for him. He'd ended up in a succession of orphanages that he tried to run away from. In the end, had managed to run away. So he'd spent his entire life absolutely alone, adult life alone, working as a janitor in various Catholic hospitals in Chicago. And at the end of his life, he became very frail and he was moved into a Catholic hospice. And his landlord cleared out his room. He was a real hoarder, so his room was full of loads of trash. And his landlord came in to clear it out. And as he was clearing it out, he started to discover paintings. Incredible, strange, profoundly disturbing paintings of a sort of civil war between adult soldiers and little girls, many of them naked and with penises, in these landscapes of opulent flowers and storms and dragons. So he's sort of picking out these pictures and being kind of bewildered. As he slowly sort of works his way through, he realises that there's not just paintings, but there's the longest novel in the world, there's all sorts of diaries, there's huge amounts of source material. And he starts to realise that this person was an artist. And now Henry Darga is fairly well known as, probably the most famous outsider artist. But during his life, as far as we know, he never showed his work to a single other human being. So he really fascinated me. He was really somebody that I knew had to be in the book somewhere.
Can you sum up his world that he has created?
Yeah, so it's basically an alternate planet, and there's a civil war going on between the Glandolinians and the Angelinians, I think it is. It's actually a while since I've looked at it. So these sort of, well, it's a bit like Trump's America, these sort of armies of violent, vicious men, and these seven little girls called the Vivian Sisters and the rest of their forces of good, their Christian forces. And really it's a succession of massacres. Basically, it's just these hugely violent acts. There'll be scenes of mass crucifixions, lynchings, disembowelings. But in these exquisite landscapes and painted with the most fabulous watercolours. So the paintings are really beautiful, really tightly organised. He was not in any way a trained artist. He was totally self-taught. And he was doing all of this in this tiny room that he also lived in. It's just the strangest story.
To what extent do we know how that world itself was his world? Do you know what I mean? Was he, like, living it?
Well, the writing that I'd always read about him said he was a mentally ill person. There's lots of sort of attempts to diagnose him by way of his diary or his paintings. And I found that really, really frustrating and sort of slightly offensive. The idea that he was using a lot of similar techniques to Warhol, that was partly what I was interested by. He seemed to me a very sort of technically inventive artist. So I decided that I'd go and spend some time in the Darga Archive, which was in Brooklyn at the time, and look at his own work. I knew he'd kept a diary, and I wanted to see what he said about his work and what he said about his life. And the thing that really struck me about it all was that he was somebody who was operating in absolute social deprivation, and at the same time it didn't seem fair to think of his work as just being expressive of that social deprivation or that borderline mental illness. I mean, I'm not actually convinced he was mental, but if he was, there was more going on in the work. It seemed much more a sustained investigation into violence, not just the violence he'd experienced, but global violence, war, which has always been a subject for artists to delve into. And so there'd be things in the biographies or things in accounts of him that would say, well, he was doing all of this unconsciously. He was completely overwhelmed by his own fantasies. But if you sit there and look at the source material that he's labelled and boxed and photocopied and enlarged and constructed, it looks like any other artist studio. It looks like somebody who is carrying out a business of forensic investigation into a series of horrendous aspects of human existence. So I felt very very moved by that. And then I think the other thing is that there's a class level to the analysis of Daga, that he's described as a hoarder, and he's described as a sort of loony person who's filling his room with all of this crap. But actually, if you put all of your own possessions into a single room, you'd look like a hoarder. He doesn't have very much space. It's not that he's got too much stuff. And then the things that he's picking up, okay, he collects a lot of shoes, but at the same time, he's collecting things like eyedroppers that he can use so that when a pencil's worked down to the tiniest stub, he can stick the eyedropper on and he can make the pencil usable. It's the habits of thrift. Mm-hmm. It's not the habits of madness. And that made me feel very angry, that sort of sense that people get isolated or get sort of turned into a strange person because of those sort of class blindnesses, I think is another driver of loneliness, a much more political driver of loneliness, I suppose.
What was it like to actually spend time yourself with his words, really, you know, living that world?
It was upsetting, actually. It was really upsetting because he came across to me as somebody intelligent. I mean, there are jokes in there. There are sort of wry jokes. And he didn't have anyone to talk to. The loneliness really came off it like a smoke almost. But he didn't feel like a crazy person to me. It felt like somebody who was never really... I mean, you know, the kind of work he was doing was just so awful and repetitive, and the nuns who were running the hospital were so cruel to him. The fact that he managed to make this much beauty and intellectually rigorous work out of such poor soil, such poor conditions, seems extraordinary to me.
I'm Emma-Jane Unsworth, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
David Wonarovich, who's the fourth of the quartet of artists that you look at, and seems to be the most meaningful to you. Tell me why.
I think I just fell in love with him, really. He wasn't an artist I knew in advance. All the others I was sort of very aware of. But when I was starting to work on this book, my friend Matt Wolfe, who's a filmmaker, said, oh, you need to put David Wonarovich in, you need to go to the archive. So I started to look at his work, and he was a gay man who had a very violent upbringing. He was homeless. He was a rent boy in New York's Times Square for a while in the 60s. And then he became an artist and a writer, and his work was very angry, very beautiful, very wild, very good at sort of analysing how the state, how political systems, how families, how churches can isolate and deny somebody's humanity. That had happened to him over and over again. And then in the 80s, he was diagnosed HIV positive. His best friend died of AIDS. And he died at the age of 37, leaving behind this sort of record of resistance, really. He was somebody who used art as a way of speaking up against enforced silencings. And I just fell in love with that. I fell in love with his courage. He wrote very, very honestly about his sexuality, his body, his illness, his fear, his rage. Rage is a real Wonarovich subject. And I was just absolutely beguiled by him. And, you know, if any of these artists really medicated my own sense of being lonely, it was David.
I think possibly my favourite part of the book is you paint this amazing picture of this world of the, you know, the dilapidated keys on the west side of Manhattan, where there's, you know, all of these falling down warehouses where there are homeless people, but there's also this sexual adventurism going on, and it's both like attractive and terrifying at the same time. Yeah. This world, it just seems so unimaginable now, such a distant world.
Yeah, and I was really interested by that. And I mean, again, like, part of my interest in that was a lot of my sort of frustrations at the time with the idea that I was in my mid-30s, I was female, that there was a way that you were supposed to live your life, and that was supposed to be a heterosexual, monogamous relationship, and I didn't want that. I was having a lot of struggles with my sense of gender and just with the sort of narrowness of the options. And so I found it hugely refreshing to read David's writing about the peers, or to read Samuel Delaney's books about Times Square, and these sort of sexual subcultures where there could be sex as a balm for loneliness without it necessarily meaning that you're going along that sort of train towards monogamy and marriage, mm-hmm. that it could be something else. And that seemed illuminating and humane to me at a point where I was so sort of frustrated and alienated by the options that seemed to be available.
But of course, that's not the direction that world goes in. As you've already mentioned, you know, the 80s come along and AIDS comes along, and this book becomes obviously there are, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people, like an incredible amount of people who died in that time, but particularly the New York art scene is devastated. A generation of artists are lost at that time as well, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And David's sort of in the thick of that. So this is the moment, where this is the plague years, really, when there's a huge amount of stigma about HIV infection. There's a huge amount of misinformation. And that sort of silencing is another kind of loneliness that I was really interested in, a kind of loneliness that cuts people off, that makes people ashamed, and that, in fact, there's research that quickened people's illnesses and deaths, because it's such a profound thing to feel that you're a pariah, that you're untouchable. But the other thing, the other reason that Wonarovich was such a hero to me is that he was part of ACT UP, he was part of the direct action group that arose out of the AIDS crisis to fight sort of the silencing and the stigmatisation by the government, by Reagan's government, and then by Bush's government, by the Catholic Church, by all of these sort of different bodies that were very much trying to turn a blind eye to what was happening in New York and other cities.
So all of these other, I mean, Peter Hujar, Keith Haring, all of these other New York artists that you also talk about in the book, but I wanted to talk about another person in particular who I wasn't aware of before I read this story, and I also spent some time on YouTube looking at this stuff, and this is Klaus Nomi. He's a German pop star, is not really right. Cabaret artist is not really right. He's one of those sort of, you know, Lee Bowery type characters.
Yeah. Except, I mean, I don't think Lee Bowery wanted to be famous like Klaus Nomi wanted to be famous. Lee Bowery was happy in the counterculture. Klaus Nomi wanted to be a superstar, but he was, you know, he was an operatic countertenor who had a sort of electropop act, but like you say, he is also a cabaret artist. He looked like an alien. He's tiny, sort of exquisitely pretty, white powder white face, very black hair, absolutely bizarre and endearing and wonderful. I mean, I love his music. I love his pop music. And he was the first famous person to die of AIDS. He was diagnosed very, very early on. The sort of descriptions of his final days, he looks like a monster and that everyone's nursing him, sort of complete barrier nursing. The isolation of that really got to me. But that's so easy to turn into this sort of victim identity of those poor people with AIDS. And the book, I think, The Lonely City, really is not about that. It's about, the reason I write about the AIDS crisis is partly to talk about how stigmatisation happens, but it's also to talk about how one of the solutions to loneliness is coming together to resist the forces of our loneliness. It's not about going on Tinder and meeting somebody. It's about thinking collectively. And that, I mean, God, in these times, like, we've all been on a demo yesterday, that feels really important, a really, really important message. Because I think those days of stigmatisation, those people that Wonarovich talks about are back in power again. It's the same old crowd. And that's their game. It is to divide and stigmatise people.
Well, I do want to talk about going on Tinder and meeting people and in that direction. You write in this book, but also in an expanded essay elsewhere, about the internet and the growth of the internet. And it was supposed to be this, you know, super connected thing that's supposed to make people less lonely. But actually, in a lot of ways, it does the opposite, in that it sort of isolates us. And, you know, it's almost a metaphor for that idea of being in a tall skyscraper looking out at all the other windows of people where you can see the life is going on, but it's not your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I wrote that book a few years ago. I mean, I finished it, a year and a half ago, and that was one moment of the internet. But there are all these sort of continuous moments of the internet, and now the internet is starting to feel even more sinister because it feels like it's a place in which right-wing community has developed itself. I think it's always so double-edged. It has such potential for alleviating people from isolation, but it's a tool. It's not a solution in itself. And the directions that people go in, their sort of ways of forming community or ways of making friendship or ways of making relationships isn't necessarily positive, I think, right now. Sort of more wary of it than I've been in a long time, really.
You talk about the work of the MIT psychologist Sherry Turkle. Tell us something about her.
Yeah, well, she's very much, she's very negative about the internet right now. I mean, she's written a series of of books, and they increasingly say that we're losing our abilities to communicate with each other directly and in person, that we're losing the facility for intimacy and empathy. And at the time that I was writing this book, I was thinking, I mean, I was very deeply an internet person. I was spending a lot of time on Twitter, and I was positive about it. I had reservations, but I thought that it was also a place where you could make connections with people who shared opinions and points of view that didn't share your physical location. In the light of recent events, in the light of the last election, I worry more that we are living in these sort of very separate bubbles, and that the desire to be surrounded by like-minded people might not be as positive as I once thought it was. That actually there's something about being able to choose who you converse and engage with on the internet that you can't do in a city when you're surrounded by actual people, that you have to make accommodations to people who are different from you in a way that you don't have to online. So, yeah, I think my opinions about the internet are kind of evolving quite fast right now.
Just one more thing then to finish off. Having studied the art, been and seen the art, written the profiles, how did that art in the final analysis help yourself with your own loneliness, and how do you think it might help other people?
I think there's this wonderful thing that David Wojnarowicz says, which is that he wanted to make things that could speak when he couldn't speak, because he was silenced, and then latterly because he wasn't going to be around anymore, and that they would speak to people who were on the same frequency, they'd speak to the people who needed them. And that really resonated with me at the time, and I think that's what a lot of the art that I look at does. It communicates something about the experience of being isolated, and by doing that it resolves it at the same time, it heals it, because if you can pick up on that and you can see that somebody else shared that, something in you unlatches, you know, you have an ally in your state, and I think that really is soothing on a very deep level. So the works that sort of most Wojnarowicz's work, some of Warhol's work actually as well, that things that really, there's a painting of Warhol by Alice Neal where he's it exposes the scars of the shooting. He's naked from the waist up. He's wearing trousers, and he's got a very unusually open expression. And there was something about that painting that I just found so entrancing, that you could look at somebody who was so badly wounded and see the beauty in it. And that, I mean, it's such a cliche, but at the same time, actually that sort of bareness or that sort of rawness does have a liberating effect on other people, I think.
I've been talking to Olivia Lang. We've been talking about her book, The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone, which is out at the beginning of March in paperback. It's out in hardback already, but at the beginning of March in paperback from Canongate. Olivia, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Joshua Jelly Shapiro is a geographer and writer whose work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, New York, Harper's, The Believer, Art Forum, and The Nation, among many other publications. Educated at Yale and Berkeley, he is the co-editor with Rebecca Solnit of Nonstop Metropolis and New York City Atlas, and a visiting scholar at New York University's Institute for Public Knowledge. And Joshua is the author of Island People, the Caribbean and the World, which we're going to talk about today. Joshua, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you, delighted to be here.
The first thing that we should know is you're a white fella, so let's talk about how you first got fascinated by the Caribbean.
Yes, indeed, I am a white fella. I grew up in the state of Vermont, so in New England, sort of northeast U.S. Yeah, which is not the most diverse place, you might say, but it's sort of a place that's full of hippies and farmers. And one of my first ins to being interested in the Caribbean was in Vermont. There was this Vermont Reggae Festival every summer, and so I was growing up there in the 1980s and 90s, and by that time, of course, reggae and roots reggae in particular really spread around the world. I think certainly among kind of counterculture people, music people, you know, become tremendously popular. So I did. I spent parts of my childhood going to these concerts in the middle of farmers' fields in Vermont, where people like Burning Spear and Culture and Third World would come and perform. So I fell in love with Jamaican music first when I was 12, 13. I had, you know, all the Marley posters in my wall, and I worked in a record store in high school, and became enamored then of Cuban music, of various other musics from the region. But then when I went to university, when I was 18, I decided I didn't want to just, you know, engage with the music as music, but to understand the history of where these cultures and sounds came from. So I studied Caribbean literature in university, started visiting the region, and really have made it my life as a scholar and writer for the last 15, 20 years.
There's a long tradition of people from elsewhere going to the Caribbean and other places and writing, you know, exotic travel stories. And I want to talk about how obviously some of those people are an influence on this book, but also how you've done things differently.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the question of genre and thinking about travel literature and travel writing, which here in the UK I think actually has a resonance that is a stronger one than in the US in certain ways. And that's partly because, of course, travel literature was in many ways a kind of imperial practice. You know, it's about these hail fellows venturing off to strange places and returning with stories about what was strange about them. And so that literature, you know, of course, did produce some writing that's really lasted. It produced some problematic writing. And, of course, the ghosts of people like Patrick Leigh Fermor and Naipaul and sort of some of the 20th century travel writers are very important to me. But what I've really endeavored to try and do in this book, I like to think of a quote from Toni Morrison who said something to the effect of that all writers in the New World have a job to create a new map of the New World that's about discovery, but that's not about conquest. And that's a lovely idea. It's harder to do in practice than to say. And of course, my experience is shaped by being a white guy with a U.S. passport. Mm-hmm. It could not be what I have access to, what I don't have access to, what I understand, what I don't. But I've tried to essentially make the aim of having of human connection, of discovery, the center of what I try and do as a travel writer. But also this book about the Caribbean, the key point about it is that where many of the people who visited the islands previously were writing about a marginal place, a place that they thought was just this old slave colonies, there's a bunch of black people there, they're not important. And to me, what I've tried to do in this book is to put the Caribbean really at the center of any story we tell ourselves about the making of the modern world.
Mm-hmm. And this is the idea behind the book, that the Caribbean is in some way the crucible in which a lot of the phenomena of the modern world began, whether that's, you know, mass immigration, capitalism, things like that. Expand on that a little.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's at the heart of this. And really what I do there is to riff in certain ways or engage with C.R.R. James, the great writer and historian from Trinidad, who wrote what's still kind of our greatest book about the Haitian Revolution, the Black Jacobins. And James argued back in the 1950s, and I build on what he had to say there, is that the Caribbean, right, for a few reasons, was really at the heart of the making of our modern world economy, of modern world culture. For one thing, the Caribbean was a place where Not just some slaves were brought, but fully 6 million enslaved Africans were brought to the Caribbean over the period of centuries. You know, in North America, what became the United States was a few hundred thousand. It was really, that was the marginal place in terms of the triangle trade. So the Caribbean was really at the center of that. It's also the case that in places like Jamaica, Barbados, and then especially in Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti, in the 1700s in Saint-Domingue, James writes about how the incredible volume of industry and production and people that were coming there and having a sophisticated division of labor and having these essentially factories in the fields, we think of as only having happened with the Industrial Revolution in mm-hmm. Europe. And he makes the contention that really those things were happening in the Caribbean first, mm-hmm. and that in those ways it was kind of a harbinger of what came next. But then also, of course, he points out that the Caribbean was this place where things that we think of as uniquely modern, like people moving thousands of miles to work at industry, like cultural mixing as a fact of life, like having to learn new languages and engage with all kinds of people, right? That was happening in the Caribbean from the 16th, 17th century on. And so that they're not sort of new phenomena there, that they've been there for a very long time. And it's hard to think of both modern culture and our modern world economy without having the Caribbean central to the story.
I want to talk about perhaps a daft-sounding question, where is it? Because you obviously, you know, there's only a limited amount of places you can cover in this book. There's thousands of islands, and you concentrate on the Greater and Lesser Antilles, and I would also, you know, I would consider that Barbados and Bermuda were part of the Caribbean, but you don't in this book. But also, there's an idea of, you know, the rim of the Caribbean Sea and places like, you know, Colombia and South and Central American countries that have some sort of, like, shared culture, perhaps?
Absolutely. No, and I'd be the first to agree with you that places like New Orleans, where I love to hang out, it was a deeply Caribbean place. Mm-hmm. Same with the north coast of Colombia, where Garcia Marquez is from. You know, 100 Years of Solitude to me is a totally Caribbean book, right? And so there is a big question running through my book and what I've tried to do with it. This question of, if you're going to talk about what the Caribbean is, of course you have to talk about where it is. And for me, my book is partly a journey through the Caribbean as idea, and it's sort of thinking about this idea of Caribbean-ness, what is it? And as I say, I absolutely concur that what we think of as Caribbean, what counts as Caribbean, includes the lands that rim the sea. It also might include places that people from the islands have emigrated to. But for the purposes of this book, and this was partly because it's already not short, I had to bound it somewhere. And I was also interested in islands as particular kinds of places, and islands as, in certain ways, symbolic of the Caribbean and of Caribbeanness. So I limited my study to the islands. But as I say, I absolutely think there are many places around the sea that could also qualify.
The converse of that question perhaps is, I mean, is there a Caribbean identity? You know, this is a place, again, as I've said, of thousands of islands, but also many languages and cultures. So do the people that live there, on the whole, identify as Caribbean?
Right. It's a great question. And I think that what's really interesting, what I found in researching this book and in engaging with the region for a very long time, is that in the political and intellectual culture of these islands, there's absolutely a strong strain of saying we're Caribbean. You know, whether we're in Martinique or Jamaica or Cuba or Trinidad, there is something that joins us, and it's about the history of slavery, and it's about living on these tropical islands, and it's about many things. Mm-hmm. Of course, on those islands, it'd be very rare to hear someone say mm-hmm. that they are Caribbean rather than Jamaican, say. But I think that one thing that's really interesting along in terms of how that conversation happens is that once people have left, once people have migrated in big numbers to places like London, to New York, to Toronto, that these cities enable conversations that don't necessarily happen in the islands. And so that you do certainly see the emergence of a West Indian identity or a Caribbean identity in these northern cities where people move, and then they party together and have carnivals together. And there's interesting ways in which that conversation is enabled in certain ways by leaving the islands.
You've mentioned C.R. James already. I wanted to talk about it. In the book, there are sort of studies of a number of Caribbean intellectuals. You mentioned V.S. Naipaul. And in fact, we should probably talk about V.S. Naipaul a little bit, because also, you know, among many things, a travel writer. Tell us something about him.
Yes, Naipaul. Well, he's sort of the unavoidable figure in writing about the Caribbean, certainly in writing a travel book about the Caribbean. One of his first books, of course, was The Middle Passage, which was a travel narrative. He'd been in England for some years and traveled back home to where he was from in Trinidad, actually commissioned to do so by the Trinidadian government, the new Trinidadian government, which is interesting because
he's famously grumpy narrative.
Yeah, he sort of proceeded to heap scorn on where he was from. He didn't love growing up in Trinidad, and I think that colored everything that he had to say about it. No, so Naipaul, of course, is a notoriously grumpy writer in general, and that portrait of the Caribbean, he notoriously called it half-made societies. And he's someone who, you know, when you go to Trinidad, of course, there's a great deal of pride that this great writer came from there. There's also a complex and vexed relationship, because as a literate friend of mine, well-lettered friend of mine there put it to me once, he said, Vidya doesn't have affection for us, so why should I have affection for him? Which was a fair point. But he is this unavoidable writer because he was such an incisive observer, great maker of sentences, and a great sort of seer through the surfaces of things to look at hypocrisies and complexities. And so he's one has to engage with him in the Caribbean and as a travel writer too.
He's such a big name. Do you think that, you know, his opinion colored how people elsewhere saw the Caribbean?
I think it's fair to suggest that for sure. I mean, he is such a big name and a revered writer with reason. It's very curious to read The Middle Passage because he, in a certain way, is adopting a kind of imperial worldview, becoming in a way kind of more English than the English in terms of the scorn that he heaps on these places. And it's quite interesting to compare him, for example, with a Patrick Leigh Fermor, who I invoke because his book, The Traveler's Tree, which came out a decade before The Middle Passage, so early 50s versus early 60s. Patrick Leigh Fermor is a, you know, very much in the grand tradition of British travel writing and venturing off into strange places. But his approach to the Caribbean, and The Traveler's Tree is a great lasting portrait of the region, he was fascinated by it and was very sort of warm and open to the place. There's are certainly bits of that book that are outmoded and wouldn't read well to us now. Yeah.
He's very much the Panama hat and flannel.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Right. No, he had his linen suit and, you know, called people Negroes and these sorts of things. So, he's aged in that way. But it's very interesting to see someone. He was a very kind of open-minded and learned and curious person. So he didn't have an agenda, so to speak, in going to the islands. I think that Naipaul really, you know, he had some sort of scores to settle in the place where he was from, and that shaped that book. And so really what I'm trying to do in this book, and it's very much in certain ways in the footsteps of those two writers especially, but is to really offer a vision of the Caribbean that, as I say, is not about presenting it as a marginal place, but presenting it as fascinating and as rich and as full of problems and trouble as we know, but also as a place, as I say, that's really central to our culture still.
It's Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Joshua Jelly Shapiro. We're talking about his book, Island People, the Caribbean and the World. And Joshua, we were just talking about Naipaul and James. And as I said, there's other towering figures mentioned in this book, Frantz Fanon and obviously Fidel Castro. But the book is called Island People, and very much the focus on discovering the region is through not towering people, ordinary people. Although, to be fair, in the Caribbean, everybody's extraordinary, it would seem.
Right. No, this is, well, I love what you're getting at there, because it's absolutely the case that what I try and do in writing about even the great figures, and I have to engage with them in this book, and am fascinated by those people you mentioned, the Fanons and Castros and Marleys and Jean Rhys's and all these people, is that what I try and do is to write about them not by writing necessarily just the facts or the stories of their lives, but to write about them by visiting with people who were around them, which is a way that, you know, many writers I admire have sort of gone about this. And I think it's a nice way to write about someone. The celebrity interview, so to speak, as any journalist can tell you, is often the worst way to learn anything insightful about someone. So going to meet people, you know, if I'm writing about Marley, to go up into the hills of St. Anne's and, you know, find the people he grew up with, or the guy who dug open his grave to turn it around because they thought his head wasn't facing the sun. These sorts of people. But what you say about outsized characters and people creating themselves as characters, I think absolutely that runs through any kind of study of Caribbean culture, the way certainly that I present it. That there seems to be something about these New World societies, and especially I think on the bigger islands, it's fair to say, where people are even more extroverted than on the little ones. But where people, there's this kind of will to create oneself as a character and to have fun with language and to be a sort of outsized figure. The performative culture, right? The music, of course, is extremely important in all of these places, as is fetting and carnival. And these things run through the islands up from the bottom to the top.
You have Chris Blackwell, obviously the head honcho of Island Records, saying, obviously in reference to Jamaica, but it could go for everywhere, that this is a place with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've already mentioned talk that I wanted to get us on to Marley, and as you've said, particularly on, you know, you look at him by going and meeting and talking to the people who knew him. As you've already mentioned that, perhaps we should talk about dancehall for a moment and your encounter with this rather colourful Lady Saw.
Lady Saw, well, absolutely. She, the sort of once and future queen of the dance hall, right? She's a remarkable figure. Of course, the thing about Jamaican music since the 1970s, since the roots reggae moment that is really what broke it worldwide through people like Marley and many others, is that in the 1980s and the 1990s and still to today, right, Jamaican music in a lot of ways turned willfully inward, in the sense that it was very much dance hall became, you know, it's much faster, it's much rougher, the recording quality is sort of intentionally not polished. Mm-hmm. Many of the lyrics are in patois, which is to say that outsiders wouldn't necessarily understand them, whereas Marley, you know, sang in beautiful English, which is part of how he got over. But Lady Saw is a great iconic figure in that world who became prominent by singing extremely slack songs, which is to say sort of sex songs, but is a very fierce feminist. You know, she's been very outspoken about the sort of strength and power of women and Jamaican women, which is interesting and important there, because this is a society that's really, many households are run by women. Mm-hmm. It's a society that really revolves around women in all kinds of ways. And so she's a great kind of feminist icon who I went to interview in a, you know, TGI Fridays, and we talked a little about songs like Stab Out the Meat, which was one of her first sort of sex ditties, which she caught a lot of flack for. But she made a great sort of coherent argument about how this was a pro-woman song. But she's a complex and interesting person. And it's worth saying, though, too, about her that she's sort of periodically found God and started singing gospel, which is interesting because she exemplifies Jamaica in that, too, that Jamaica's an extremely religious place. You know, people like to say that there's more churches there per square mile than anywhere, which is one of those kind of totally unverifiable stories, but one believes it because as the saying goes, you know, the Jesus business is good in Jamaica. But it's interesting because dance hall culture and what's raucous and raw and incredibly sort of suffused with sex and crassness about the musical culture there is not the most Christian, you might say. But there's an interesting tension kind of running through running through Jamaican culture in that way.
I wanted to talk about Rand Jamaica, the contradictions of trying to sell Jamaica as a sort of tropical paradise for tourists. Like, everybody would, you know that the capital of Jamaica is Kingston, but in this book, you know, you fly to Kingston and you're pretty much the only white person on the plane because tourists just don't go to Kingston.
Right. No, exactly. That's people sometimes fly into Kingston, but then they get on their bus and they go away. So Kingston is, no, precisely, Kingston's the capital of the country, but it's not where the resorts are. And this idea of Brand Jamaica that the Jamaican government has been touting for some time now, and which actually dates way back to around the time of independence in 1962, but has been brought back recently. And of course, initially it was just about creating Jamaica as a great tourist destination and touting its sand and its sea which it has very beautiful beaches and so on. But the thing is that every island in the Caribbean has great beaches. And so Jamaica, of course, is aware of the fact that they do have this extraordinary music that has influenced the world, that's visible everywhere. And so this idea of Brand Jamaica, the new idea, is very much about, oh, how are we going to capitalize on our visibility? We have our music, we have our sprinters, we have people like Usain Bolt, and you know, maybe that's a sort of route to development. I think, personally, as I write about in the book, that it's a tricky argument. For one thing, sort of capitalizing on music in our digital age is a hard thing to do. And Jamaican culture, as I explore at length, you know, is this incredibly rich, varied, wonderful culture. How one capitalizes on it or monetizes it, so to speak, is a trickier question. But I think people, even in the realm of tourism, you know, there are people who are thinking about it in better and more progressive ways. That tourism for a very long time has been about, you know, flying people into these resorts and they never leave the resort. And it's really a losing deal in a lot of ways because many of those hotels are not even owned by people on the island. Mm-hmm. They're owned by Spanish conglomerates or whoever. And the people who fly there, they don't really get to know anything about Jamaica. They might as well be in the Dominican Republic. And next year they might go there if it's cheaper. But there are people who are trying to think about doing tourism in a better way. Chris Blackwell is actually one of them, that he, you know, runs all these very lovely kind of high-end resorts, Goldeneye and Strawberry Hill and places. But he's very keen. He grew up in Jamaica and loves the place and is very keen to say that if you want to come here, you know, the thing to do is to get off of the resort and engage with people and engage with how they live and the music they listen to and the food they eat. And because Jamaicans are remarkable, incredible talkers and musicians and creators of culture.
I've talked on the show before with the journalist Johan Grillo about the garrisons and the rise and fall of Dudas, the Don. But also, I'm keen to move away from Jamaica, as we've been like for ages. So let's move on to Trinidad.
Yeah.
I don't even necessarily just want to focus on Trinidad and crime, but there is a scene in the book where you have a gun pulled on you, so perhaps we should. What's happening in Trinidad?
Well, Trinidad, there is a moment in a book where we get held up at gunpoint, it's true, but I only give it a sentence. I don't dwell on it. But it's... But yeah, Trinidad is, you know, Trinidad crime is a real issue there for sure. But it's a place, Trinidad's a big island, right? I mean, not big geographically, but it's got over a million people way down, of course, at the southern end of the Antilles. And it's always been a destination for people from small islands. People go there for work. It's always had a stronger economy relatively to its neighbors. It also is right off Venezuela, so there's oil and oil money. So it is this place that has some sort of wealth. It's also, of course, the place that I mean, I love Trinidad dearly. I've lived there off and on for little stretches, and I've just been enthralled and fascinated by the culture and the dynamism of it. Trinidad, of course, is quite distinct from the other British islands in that it wasn't always British. You know, it was Spanish for a long time at the beginning after Columbus sort of turned up there, and then there were a lot of French people who settled there because the Spanish wanted to populate it, and they said other Catholics could come. And then it finally became English, but they didn't, unlike Barbados, which is not far from Trinidad, right? Barbados was just English for, you know, it's been English for nearly 400 years now. And it was a plantation colony, and that's what it was. Trinidad, you know, had slavery, but just for a few decades once the Brits took over. Then, of course, once slavery was ended. They needed other people to cut sugarcane and work on the cocoa plantation, so imported hundreds of thousands of indentured workers from India. And so what you have now in Trinidad is this fascinating, unique ethnic mix and culture where, you know, it's in large measure African, in large measure Indian. It's very mixed, but you have people from everywhere, Chinese, Portuguese, and then everyone parties in a Catholic carnival. You know, so it's a great, incredible mishmash. And to me, Trinidad is a great kind of microcosm for the Caribbean, for the New World, that all these histories and cultures overlapping and trying to create something new and something joyous and interesting. And of course, the dynamism of that is really pretty irresistible to me. And of course, Trinidad, one thing about it is that Trinidadian music is every bit as rich and marvelous as Jamaican music, calypso and soca and so on, steel band. But Trinidad never had its Marley. You know, mm-hmm. Trinidad never had its crossover star, its world star. It did have, of course, there's great legendary calypsonians, Lord Kitchener and Mighty Sparrow, who every West Indian everywhere knows. But they never had the kind of the crossover thing to lots of white people or rock fans got into. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting. So Trinidad, I think, is a little bit of a better kept secret in the sense of sort of world culture. But I think, you know, it's very interesting. That's starting to change in a kind of covert way. But now, of course, soca, which is the music that people dance to during carnival, and it's more, you know, raucous and fast-paced than calypso. But now there's been a remarkable kind of stretch of pop hits and northern pop stars who are very into soca, and partly that's about acts like Major Lazer and the producer Diplo and people like this who've been kind of, you know, hip to soca and into spreading it. But, you know, Justin Bieber had a massive hit last year. That's just a, you know, it's soca. So these rhythms really do run through and shape pop music, and they have been doing now for decades, and Trinidad in certain ways as much as Jamaica.
We're nearly out of time, and we've barely touched on many of the islands. The book has stories of Haiti and Grenada and Martinique and Dominica and Cuba, but I want to finish off right back at the beginning, and there's an epigram from the writer Julio Diaz at the beginning of the book which says, "We're all in the Caribbean, if you think about it." So do you agree?
I do. Why? I better if I put it at the beginning of my book. It's a good sort of provocative way to start off. But of course, what I like to think he meant by that, I can remember actually when I heard him say it, I was just in a bookstore reading, this was years ago, so it's just a remark he made. But of course, he was gesturing at what I write about in this book, that the Caribbean, in a lot of ways, as he would put it, is the ground zero of the New World, which is to say it's also the kind of ground zero of our modern world economy. It's where Columbus went first. It's where slavery happened. It's where long-distance trade, all these things happened, mm-hmm. in this crazy laboratory for bringing people together and in new ways, often in incredibly violent ways. But I think that what has then developed there in this part of the world and among people from that part of the world in diaspora is something that's absolutely central to our modern world culture. It was central to starting our modern world economy, and it's at the heart of our culture now. So that's my contention in the book, and so I think old Juno was right.
So I've been talking to Joshua Jelly Shapiro. We've been talking about Island People, the Caribbean and the World, which is out now from Canongate Books. Joshua, thanks so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.